This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
Hello, and welcome to another World of UX podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thanks for taking the time to join us on today. A special welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time. We just completed, finally, the series where we were talking about the sinister traits that are at work today in the world of UX. And we promised last week that we were going to go one step further, just a tad further with this. It was a very long series. I've never engaged in a series that took that much time to present, both in length of episodes as well as length of recording time. And it's much needed in our day and time. We are operating, those in UX today are operating in an arena. We're operating in a time where the discipline is upside down. Real UX is no longer really respected on average. A lot of the people running UX departments, frankly, and they're not really UX people. They don't really value the discipline. They don't know how to evaluate talent. They don't know how to hire. They don't know how to drive and manage UX maturity. And a lot of these things, when you stir up that little pot, if you will, with all those being metaphorical ingredients, it makes it for a really tough space. And for those of us who have been in UX, say 8 to 10 years or more, there's been a very heavy investment on everybody's part to be a part of this discipline. You have gone and gotten degrees. You have taken time to read all kinds of books, build your libraries, digest information from some of the world's leading thought leaders in this discipline today. We've done so much. We've gone to so many conferences. We've done so many things. We've put forth so much effort to be the absolute best we can be, only for some people to come along, turn everything upside down, and really make all the effort that everybody put into this, all the investment that has been made, to make it of none effect. Basically, it's as if we didn't do any of these things. You have degrees. It's almost like today, depending upon where you work, it's like you don't have a degree because nobody values it. You can apply for a UX job somewhere and you get the little boilerplate copycat rejection notice saying, oh, thanks for considering our company. We regret to inform you that we're not going to move forward. We have other people that are more closely aligned with the role. And there were a lot of people who applied for this role, and they just continue telling you all this irrelevant, ridiculous stuff. Okay, if you didn't get the job, you didn't get the job. Stop making excuses. And most notably, stop making excuses for yourself. Those types of rejection notices come from places where there is a problem. There could be a problem with HR in those organizations. There could be a problem with organizational toxicity in those kinds of companies. There's definitely a problem with UX if those are the notices going out and nobody's trying to change it so it's either more humane, more sensible, less insulting. But that's not what's happening today. And you get these notices all the time. There's no way in the world, especially the part where they talk about how many people apply for the role. Who cares how many people apply for the role? And even if a lot of people did apply for the role, there are people, I know of people, who are applying for roles at companies and getting rejected, and they dwarf pretty much everybody else that's applying. There's no way in the world that people are even reviewing the candidates. I know firsthand of situations where people apply for roles. After they apply for roles, the recruiters, who know nothing about UX in many instances, they go in and they look for certain things. They cast off certain folks. A lot of recruiters are very ageist. Isn't it something? You have people working in HR that are doing things that if it got out, they would get sued because of the discrimination that's at work. It's really ridiculous. But UX I can't think of another word. It's sinister. It's just downright sinister today. And part of what we were getting at in that series was that the traits we were identifying were things that are happening in UX. It's one thing for these things to happen. It's another thing for these things to be accepted, for these things to be normalized, for these things to be encouraged. And that's what makes them more sinister than anything else. So, as mentioned last week, we're going to extract 10 things. I'm referring to these as the top 10 sinister UX traits list. For the purpose of the episode, the title of the episode is the top 10 sinister UX traits revisited. You can call it Sinister Revisited for short if you choose to do so. But we need to understand what these things are. We need to know that nobody can ever overcome anything until they accurately identify it, because that's the point at which strategy begins. It's not until we realize that we're tired of something that we actually start to try and change it. So the purpose of all of these episodes was to try to put things on the radar of those who care, those who are in a position to affect change, which is interesting because UX people are change agents, not the cult of UX. There is no change agents in the cult of UX. Their change was to change UX into something that it is not. And unfortunately, and sad to inform you, especially if you're new to UX, but they have succeeded. They have succeeded. You can do actual UX now, and you can actually suffer consequences for doing real UX work. You can be subject to disciplinary activities for doing what you were supposed to do in a given setting. That's the way it is today. So it takes courage to stand up and do the right thing, because in a lot of cases, it's not going to be valued. It's not going to be rewarded. It's not going to be embraced. As a matter of fact, people will come against you if you're willing to do the right thing. It's important to know this, and then folks have to make a decision that you're going to stand for what is right, regardless of what happens, and continue to go forward. So, but that all that said, let's get into the top 10 sinister UX traits, or Sinister Revisited, where I've extracted 10 traits that we're going to address here in this episode. Let's go ahead and dive in. Trait number 10, and we're going to count backwards, and you could flip-flop these. Somebody else, you may think that there's another top 10. That's fine. I'm presenting the top 10 that stood out to me as I reviewed the entire list. And number 10 on this list is how people with little to no experience in UX in 2024, it's been going on for a few years, but it's like at a pinnacle level today, little to no experience, and they are refuting, rejecting, casting aside people who have more experience than they do, instead of realizing that you can forge a relationship with these people, and through that relationship, you can vault yourself forward. You can actually engage with them, and a lot of these people are very happy to have someone sort of piggyback with them and to learn things to help further them in the discipline. But instead of doing that, folks would rather, as I've said many times, they'd rather work together to try to get the senior person fired. I've heard of several stories like that. They'd rather pretend like we don't exist or what we're doing is old school. And we'll address that again shortly, because one of those elements made the list as well. And isn't it ironic that people, they'll reject people who have more experience when it's convenient to do so. But at the same time, while pretending that people who are more senior don't exist, or trying to ignore what seniors bring to the table, or trying to devalue us, they'll turn around and talk about how important it is to have a mentor. Well, aren't the mentors people who have more experience? So as long as it's convenient, as long as it fits their narrative, as long as it rolls up into their bias, a lot of these people will embrace it, these sinister folks in UX today, and they do outnumber us today, enough to cause a lot of problems, that's for sure. This is the way things are in UX today. People don't want to see folks who have more experience as a target place to achieve. Wow, you've done this. Man, I look forward to being in the same position as you someday. Instead of doing that, they look at you when you have more experience, and then they just have daggers for those individuals. And so this brings a very toxic element into the culture of the discipline, but it's a reality today too. So that's number 10. Number 9, neuroticism is in overdrive. And it was said a different way during the series. And I did mention neuroticism. I mentioned neuroticism and overdrive, but I'm going to say a few things here that are going to be a little bit different. I'm going to expound on some things that I said earlier when I talk about the neuroticism. Now, some people hear that and they wonder, what is neuroticism? Can you help me understand that? The neurotic people will go, neurotic? We're not neurotic. And yeah, because that's why you react that way, because those people are neurotic. They also have an EQ deficiency, because self-awareness would help someone to know, you know what? I'm too easily irritated. That's trait number one of neuroticism. Number two, they're hypersensitive. If people that are hypersensitive and don't want to hear anybody say anything that they're doing wrong, they take it personally instead of recognizing the benefit of understanding what you're doing. It might be out of order, or might not be beneficial. Let's put it that way. Neurotic people are emotionally volatile. They become emotional about things that there should be no emotions associated with the thing. Although, yeah, I mean, things may make you feel a particular way, but when we're dominated by emotion, that is an EQ problem. And so again, neurotic people are emotionally volatile. And then last one, and this is a big one, one of the things associated with neurotic mindsets and neurotic behavior and attitude is that neurotics, their level of self-doubt is off the charts. Now, what's interesting about this, and this is one thing I didn't mention when we were talking about this during the full series, is that self-doubt, it's something that when you experience it, you're human. If you ever tried skiing, the first time you got on skis and tried to do something on your own, you had self-doubt. Have you ever gone bowling? Have you ever gone axe throwing? Have you ever gone and maybe tried your hand at soccer, or as what the people in outside of the U.S. just refer to as football? It's their football, not our football, though. So that's why sometimes some people will say American football. I mean, you can name anything. If you're trying to cook and you know you haven't been good at cooking, if you're trying to work on the car, you're becoming a hobbyist and you're trying to work on an automobile. If you're trying your hand, I know people who are really great at knitting and crocheting and things like that. When you start to do something for the first time, all of us, every last single one of us, we experience self-doubt. What has happened, it's not just in UX circles, but it's just really at epidemic levels in UX circles, is that when people experience self-doubt, because people keep promoting the embracing of imposter syndrome, people who are experiencing self-doubt, and that self-doubt, especially when it's really high, they hear somebody talk about imposter syndrome, and they're very quick to say, you know what? That's what I have. It's imposter syndrome. They never consider the fact that they might be being neurotic, especially if you have the other traits, because self-doubt alone is not neuroticism. And no, it still is not. It's not imposter syndrome either. Self-doubt by itself is self-doubt. And it just means you're a human being. So welcome to the club. So a lot of times the people who are neurotic, they have self-doubt. I remember telling somebody once that they were claiming they had imposter syndrome, and I was letting them know there's actually no such thing as imposter syndrome. And I gave them the history of imposter syndrome, and I let them know it's not something that somebody can be diagnosed with. It's not even a thing in the circles where it originated from, let alone outside of those circles with people who work with those types of sciences. But I told the person, I tried to explain to them what was really going on. They were just experiencing self-doubt. And the person was actually, they were reminiscing about their early days in UX. And I let them know, no, you were just doubting yourself, and that's normal. And the person became hostile, aka easily irritated. The person became hypersensitive about anything. They started demonstrating that they were emotionally volatile. They began to raise a bunch of straw man arguments to counter what I had said about them, so that volatility was on display and the self-doubt was already there. Hence, we were talking about neuroticism. The person was having a neurotic break, if you will. And again, nobody can overcome anything until they accurately identify it. So this is where we are today. And if you want to thrive in UX, you cannot be neurotic. You cannot be hypersensitive. You cannot get easily irritated. As a matter of fact, you have to have thick skin. And a lot of us did not have thick skin when we started, nor do we expect people to have thick skin when they start in UX. But over time, that skin does have to get thicker. You cannot be easily irritated. You cannot take critiques of your designs personally. Neuroticism, though, the point I'm trying to make is that it is an overdrive. And again, it's sinister because it's being normalized. It's being sinister because it's being encouraged. It's considered to be sinister because people are trying to make it like it's okay to be this way. It's not. And it's doing great damage to the discipline. It's causing us to be misrepresented. It's causing us to be thought of as being oversensitive when we're interacting with stakeholders. We forget that they have a perception of UX. We're not helping if we behave in a neurotic manner. So neuroticism and overdrive, not good. That's number 9. Number 8. This one amazes me, and this one is getting far worse, and I'm even surprised I only have it as number 8 on this list. But there are still way too many folks in UX today, and this is happening because people are coming into UX thinking this is a thing, and then 3 to 4 years later, they run into somebody like me that says, there's no such thing as UX, UI. Number 8 is that there are folks that still don't know. People been in UX now for 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and they still don't know that whole UX / UI thing is reflective of a misdirected mindset. They don't realize that it's wrong. They don't realize that there is no such thing. They don't realize that UI is a subset of UX. They don't realize that this has to be overcome in order to represent the discipline properly and function properly. But remember, UX is not UI. There is no such thing as UX / UI, or for the smart alecks out there, there's no such thing as UI / UX. It doesn't matter if there's a slash in it, it's not right. Again, we don't say, I'm going to pick up the kids / stop at a traffic light. We don't say, I'm going to eat dinner / meatloaf, or I'm going to eat dinner / green beans. We don't say, I'm going to apply for the job / speak to a hiring manager. We just say what we're going to do. And when you say you're doing UX, it may or not be inclusive of doing UI work, but there's no reason to say UX / UI. We don't say I'm going to do UX research / card sorting. We don't say I'm going to do information architecture / work on the navigation. Using improper terminology misrepresents the discipline, and it creates problems we're going to eventually have to double back and overcome. And probably one of the greatest misrepresentations of UX has been done via the use of the UX / UI combo acronym. And sadly, it's being done by a lot of people in the discipline. We are doing damage to our own place of habitation. We've got to combat this. We've got to overcome it. Number 7, another big one. Again, difficult to set an order for these, but this one I listed at number 7. The overvaluing of portfolios. I saw a great article that's listed in the ACM Digital Library, and it's called An Industry in Flux. If you ever get a chance to read this article, please do so. It's really dynamite. There's a lot of great stuff in it. There's some things in it that I question, but I'm not worried about that as much as I am how great the message was that they were sharing in this article. And one of the things they said that was contributing to the flux that we're in as a discipline was how people were depending on boot camps to get educated about the discipline. Now some people will become immediately neurotic and they get sensitive when they hear mention of boot camps, And then I'm thankful for some people who went through the boot camps, came to the realization of what really transpired in their being in the boot camp, and they don't get sensitive when they hear it. They just shake their head because they start to remember some of what they experienced. But in this particular article entitled "An Industry in Flux," they refer to boot camps as portfolio farms. And they talked about how people who go to boot camps are more interested in coming out with a portfolio that they can use to get a job than they are to actually be sound, qualified, and skilled in the discipline. Isn't it amazing? Because they have that mindset because that's what people are selling them on. You need a portfolio, you need a portfolio, you need a portfolio. There is no, you don't hear a parallel mantra that you need to be qualified, you need to be qualified, you need to be qualified, or you need to be skilled, you need to be skilled, you need to be skilled. You keep hearing you need a portfolio. And so the emphasis is there. So people who don't realize they're being brainwashed because of the way stuff is being presented. Yeah, I said it. People are being brainwashed because of what's being presented here with all the emphasis being on portfolios. And nobody talks about how certain fundamentals are being overlooked. And we'll talk about that again shortly, but fundamentals are being overlooked. Everything is being presented at a very high level. So people don't come out with any level of mastery with regard to the content and the subject matter that's being covered, but they want that portfolio. Portfolios are overvalued to the extent that the aforementioned people who are running a lot of UX departments that don't know how to hire and don't really know what UX is, ironically, you got to have a portfolio to apply for a job with them. And they don't know that the portfolio is only telling a portion of the story and many times is not really representing the applicant properly. And not to mention the fact that portfolios are used to discriminate against people who've been in a discipline for a longer period of time than your run-of-the-mill kind of entry-level, your 0 to 3 level practitioners when it comes to years in the discipline. Once you get to the people who've been doing it for 5 to 10 years, 10 to 15 years, 15 to 20, the less you need a portfolio. But even for the early year practitioners, it's how do they communicate? That's something else that was said in another article I was reading recently. Someone did a lot of research about UX education, and they were talking about how that a lot of people go through these programs, they go through these boot camps, they're not taught how to communicate, they're not taught how to engage with stakeholders, they're not taught how to represent the discipline to clients. And so this is part of the reason we're in this state of flux, if I can borrow that term again from the authors of that article. Portfolios are not what people think they are, and they certainly don't have the currency, the level of currency, I should say, that people think that they have. So, but again, that's number 7. Got to overcome that. Number 6, we're almost at the halfway point. The put yourself out there mentality is a huge problem for UX today, especially when the people putting themselves out there lack critical thinking and or don't really have nothing to offer. This is one of the main reasons why the levels of misinformation that we are being subjected to in the discipline today are off the charts, because you have people who are just wanting to say something. They don't realize that just because you can say something doesn't mean you should. And just because you say something doesn't make it accurate. Just because you say something doesn't make it valuable. And then people like me have to spend time addressing it because the people who are doing it don't have the sensitivity to realize that they shouldn't be. But people will tell folks, you need to put yourself out there. That's how you get hired. You need to put yourself out there. That's how you get known. No. How about going back to what we just said? The thing that keeps getting overlooked. How about going and building the actual skill? How about actually becoming qualified? How about actually knowing your craft? And there's been a lot of talk lately that's starting to come up. People need to, they're starting to just refer to it as building craft. And that's acumen. Call it craft, call it acumen, call it going back to the fundamentals, whatever you want to call it. A lot of people are not doing it. And they are striving to be in a certain position in UX today without having that craft. They want to put themselves out there. And that's why you have all these crazy videos and all this fluff and all this cesspool-oriented content on Medium and things like that. because people are trying to put themselves out there and they have followings. People, I'm a content creator. You know, but you not even been in the discipline 5 years yet, and surely you haven't been doing the work. And so when you have people that all they do is focus on content creation, but they don't have the expertise, all that is doing is funneling into this massive amount of misinformation, which is not good for anybody. And yeah, it does make us look bad because stakeholders and clients come into contact with this misinformation. And while you, under the sound of my voice right now, may not have been responsible for producing that stuff, they're going to look at you, they're going to look at me as if we're responsible for it. And technically we are, because we tolerate it. We didn't call it out. So just something else to note. Number five, the number five sinister trait on this top 10 list is the acceptance of character assassination and cancel culture, that people have made this a part of UX. That there are people who think it's okay to assassinate character. It's okay to subject someone to today's ridiculous cancel culture, which ironically, you know who's at the core of the cancel culture? Neurotic people. Neurotic people who will make a stink about anything under the sun because they're so hypersensitive and they're so emotionally just imbalanced. Frankly, they want to complain about something. You don't have to really do anything for them to complain about it. They just want to complain about something. So this should not be. Character assassination makes no sense. Many times when people are assassinating character, they're simply misrepresenting somebody. They're saying something that's not true. They're saying something they don't have any evidence for whatsoever. Somebody just doesn't like someone, or somebody's trying to get revenge on someone. They're playing the little third grader game, and then they use the people who listen to them as pawns in their game of assassination. There's gaslighting that's associated to that. It's not on the list, but it's associated with that. The people who engage in the cancel culture bit and the character assassination, a lot of times are trying to gaslight people because they want to do harm to the person who's the target of the character assassination or the cancellation, I should say. Not good. And interestingly, as a side note, I had a great conversation with someone today. And we were talking about the UXPA award issue, where someone received a lifetime achievement award. And then that person, after receiving the award, had that award rescinded because the UX community was in outrage because they said that this person should not have received the award because they supposedly had been guilty of something, some very poor behavior. We'll just say it that way. And what the person had shared with me was that it's interesting how that this person, how the award was rescinded, because actually this individual, though people were saying that they did X, Y, and Z, the word is that nobody actually has any evidence that the person did anything that was wrong. And in addition to that, the person was saying that based on what people were saying, it wasn't that the person actually did something wrong, just telling you what they said. And if this is the case, it is another case of character assassination and cancel culture at work. Something, again, that people deem to be viable. When the person told me that what this person did, I'm not going to repeat what they said, but what the person did was something that, depending upon what culture you're in, there's nothing wrong with it. This person did something, and according to the report that I received, what this person did was something that people in the United States don't like, but people in Europe, it's a non-issue at all. The language this person used was not a thing at all. So if that was the case, people need to be more understanding of cultural variance. So people experience a cultural variance and then apply their culture to it, instead of looking at it from the perspective of that person's culture or even other people's cultures for that matter. And so then the outrage came out of it, and then the UXPA responded to the outrage and basically pressured to do what they did. But if you left it up to them, I mean, they gave the award. Were they going to take the award back? No. So this is something that folks need to take into consideration. A lot of this happens. A lot of people get their characters assassinated. A lot of people get subjected to cancel culture, and it's not justified at all. and we need to stop doing this. Again, we're talking about UX because this is our domain. People just need to stop doing this stuff, period. It's not right at all. So, but we'll move on to number four. And number four is there is a failure to recognize and embrace gatekeeping. And there's an episode on this topic coming up in the not too distant future. But people don't realize what gatekeeping is. They hear gatekeeping from a negative perspective. And those who listen to the show know that I don't like using the word negative, but I think it helps to in what we're trying to communicate here. People think gatekeeping is a bad thing. They think it's something that is harmful. They don't realize that gatekeeping is simply about quality advocacy. It's simply about ensuring that things are done in a proper and a respectful manner that benefits the masses and not just one individual. Gatekeeping is about making sure that we embrace and uplift standards that everybody can follow. And in so doing, it benefits an entire discipline. Basically speaking, there's nothing wrong with gatekeeping. But because people paint this picture that gatekeeping is bad and people are afraid of it, and because people in many cases realize that they cannot measure up to what gatekeeping has to say, so because of convenience, they fight against gatekeeping. But gatekeeping is actually good. And this is one of the most, I mean, I'm surprised that you know that number one through three are going to be doozies if this is number four, right? Gatekeeping is good. We need gatekeeping. Every discipline on the face of the earth thrives because of gatekeeping. And UX is in this current downward trend and downward spiral. Because we do not embrace gatekeeping. There's only a select few. There's only a certain minority that embrace gatekeeping today. The more we embrace gatekeeping, the better off we'll be. And we'll be able to represent the discipline properly. People will begin to ascribe the value to UX that they should. But while everything is upside down and the cult of UX is more readily accepted and pure UX is being pushed out, we're going to continue to suffer. Gatekeeping, if we survive and we thrive, it will be because gatekeeping has been restored to its rightful place. So let's keep that in mind on today. Number three, mentioned this earlier, so now we'll spend time that's dedicated to this topic. Number three, fundamentals. There's too many people that just don't like fundamentals. There's too many people that hate fundamentals. There's too many people that don't understand fundamentals. Too many people that don't value fundamentals. So to speak specifically of what I'm entitling number three, there are too many people that are fundamentals averse in UX today. And a lot of people, you can talk about fundamentals in certain circles and people will say, oh man, that's old school. There's nothing old school about heuristics. There's nothing old school. I mean, in a detrimental sense, there's nothing old school about usability. There's nothing old school about information architecture. There's nothing old school about UX research. There's nothing old school about interaction design principles. People fight against them. People don't want to learn them because people are lazy, frankly. Fundamentals are critical to the discipline. Information architecture, I talk about that particular one all the time because what information architecture produces, which is findability, is key and is core to every valuable and valid user experience. But people want to act like information architecture is not key and then try to achieve what is afforded to us through information architecture. You're not going to get there. You're going to have to present a sound information architecture. You're going to have properly labeled nomenclatures. You're going to have properly structured taxonomies. And in so doing, you have strong information sense and findability is achieved. So this is a fundamental that is key. We don't have UX without fundamentals, folks. But folks are trying to present fundamentals or trying to present UX, trying to present UX that is void of fundamentals. And that simply is not doable. Once you do that, it's no longer UX, which is, again, why we make the differentiation between pure UX and the cult of UX. Because in the cult of UX, there are no fundamentals. In the cult of UX, everybody's a Figma wizard. and you just go and grab Figma and have Figma will travel. And people don't realize that being able to use Figma properly from a UX perspective requires that you have the fundamentals down pat. Without it, you have nothing. You're just a person occupying space. You're just a butt in a seat. That's all you are, and it's not good. Number two, almost there. Number two, UX today is overrun with hubris. Just overrun with hubris today. Dunning-Kruger is the order of the day. People think of themselves more highly than they ought. They think they know more than they do. They think they're better at UX than really what they truly are. People just are just drunk with hubris today. That same article that I mentioned earlier about UX being an industry in flux talked about this, that a lot of these boot camps, a lot of these learn UX in 90 days or however you want to say it. I mean, they say it a lot of different ways. A lot of these places get people to think. I have actually said on multiple occasions that they infect people with a sense of Dunning-Kruger, and that they come out of these learning experiences, if you can even call it that, with a heightened sense of confidence that's not justifiable at all. And when you really see these people come face to face with the work, they start to have self-doubt. What we were talking about earlier, I even saw a post today on LinkedIn where someone said that over 40% of people in UX today have imposter syndrome. That's number one. It can't be accurate because there's no such thing as imposter syndrome. Number one, even if imposter syndrome was a thing, if it is 40%, it's because you have 400,000 people who graduated from the Google program, and because you have so many people who went through boot camps. Basically speaking, you have people that are learning UX the wrong way. Then yeah, you're going to have self-doubt because you didn't learn how to do it. If you learn how to use the fundamentals, learn what they are, learn how to use them, learn when the best time is to apply them, you don't have what these people call imposter syndrome, and you only experience self-doubt because it's the first few times that you're doing something. But eventually, as is the case with everything else, you outgrow self-doubt. Everybody grows out of that. Remember riding a bike for the first time and you had doubt and you had those training wheels? And remember when they took the training wheels off and you had some self-doubt? But then after you started riding without the training wheels, self-doubt begins to dissipate. It just starts to vanish. That's the same thing that happens when people actually start really applying themselves to the craft. The self-doubt goes away. And ironically, a lot of these people who claim to have imposter syndrome, they just hold on to it. You ever met somebody who said they have imposter syndrome and 5 years later, they still said they had it? And when you talk to them, you find out they haven't done anything to put that to rest. They haven't done anything to overcome it. So this really sad stuff. Hubris. Isn't it amazing that people have hubris and have imposter syndrome, or they claim to have imposter syndrome? That doesn't work. That's not how any of these things work. Hubris is destroying the discipline. Because you have these people, they believe in fake it till you make it. That's the same crowd. They'll tell you that you need to fake it till you make it. And that C-suite person and that client that you were doing work for, who saw you do a fake it till you make it presentation, they know that you were faking it. And because of that, they lose confidence in UX. We need to produce confident people. We need to produce informed people. We need to produce skilled people. This is why all of this stuff is important. And we need to overcome all of these traits associated with sinister operation in UX today, because it is not good for the practice. It is not good for the practitioner. It is not good for your teams. It's not good for your customers, your clients, your stakeholders. It's not good for anybody. We got to do away with hubris, replace it with actual sheer authentic skill. How about that today? Some people won't do it because they don't like to do work. A lot of people actually came into UX because they didn't think there was going to be any work involved. UX is a lot of work, and people that are work averse, they just need to either get with the program or find something else to do. You want to do something where there's no work? Find another discipline that does not have people's lives at stake based on the experience that you deploy. We're down to number one. The number one issue, I've already mentioned it actually a couple times, so we'll give you, I wish I had a drum roll here for this one, but this very last sinister trait is when I sat and looked at this list of over 60 sinister traits at work in UX today, I was surprised that I identified this as number one. But this one is number one because of everybody that's impacted by it. The number one sinister UX trait on my list is the predominant hire of unqualified people to run UX teams. When a company hires a person who does not understand UX, who does not know what UX really is, I know people who have run UX teams and said that they hate UX. I've seen that. How in the world can you put a person over the UX team that hates UX? These people will not hire extensively qualified individuals to be on the team. And every team needs a resident senior, at least one. Depending upon the size of the team, you're going to need more. So for X number of people who are mid-level and junior, you're going to need to have a true senior on the team. And this kind of stuff, these are the people behind people getting senior jobs with 1 to 2 or 3 years of experience these days. People getting director roles and manager roles with 1 year of experience. These are the people who have somebody on the team with 10 or more years of experience and will actually fire or lay this person off, just dismiss this person, get them off the team, and go ahead and ride forward with people who don't know what they're doing. And this is because a lot of people in these organizations, they want a yes person in that position. They don't really want UX to operate properly. They just want to satisfy somebody in the organization who wanted to have a UX team, so they put anybody over that team. But I have seen, only seen, 1 out of 50 situations where the person over the team that does not know anything about UX, who has the responsibility of running the team, who actually did it in a way that was reflective of proper levels of emotional intelligence, who was professional in the way that they operated, who actually understood that the people on the team knew more about UX than them and got out of the way and let us do our jobs. I've only seen that in one instance, maybe two. I'll say that just in case I'm forgetting someone or somebody. But for the most part, the people who were put over the teams actually sold somebody on their ability to run the team, even though they really didn't have a UX background, even though they weren't educated about UX, even though they didn't have the hands-on practice. So they didn't know, people who don't have hands-on practice don't know what it takes to actually do the job. So when they have people on the team who know how to do UX work and you have somebody running the team that doesn't, good luck communicating with them. Good luck having them support you. Good luck when other people who don't know what UX is come to them with a complaint or an issue that's not an issue and not a complaint, and having that person actually stand by your side and actually represent you the right way. They're not going to do it because they don't know. People with UX have to have thick skin. People who don't know anything about UX a lot of times don't have thick skin. And so they're going to fall prey, or they're going to be preyed upon by the people who might be manipulative, who don't understand UX, who don't value UX, who want the UX team to go away. People who don't know what UX is and are not practitioners cannot properly fulfill the role that's needed by the people on the UX team. I've seen and heard of situations where people just had the idea, you know, we need a UX team. And they'll say, you know what? You'll be in charge of it. And they didn't necessarily expect that, but they ended up being put in charge of the team. They didn't know what they were doing and end up advancing their own personal maturity in a dysfunctional way. So they're not going to be able to stand for the team. The people who don't know anything about UX running teams don't know how to communicate with HR. They don't know, I said this already, they don't know how to represent the positions right when it comes to the job postings. There will be things that are not necessary. These are the people who go out into the wild and copy other UX job postings to create theirs. That's one of the reasons why a lot of UX job postings are a mess. Or does this make sense now? Do you understand why this is number one? Because of how many people are being impacted in a detrimental way by these people? Unqualified people running UX teams is by far the absolute worst thing that has happened to UX operations today. And until this trend starts to move in the opposite direction, we are going to continue to experience the byproduct of this improper hire. Until teams start to put actual UX people, and not the people who got hired and they weren't supposed to be hired at the 2-3 year level, and then when they reach the 10-15 year level, you put them over the team. Not those people. There's a whole wave of people who have been overlooked. There's a whole wave of people that have been displaced. There's a whole wave of people. I mean, don't even interview those people for these roles when they don't really qualify. This type of thing is not good, folks. This type of thing is hurting the discipline. And again, for those of us who have invested up the wazoo, trying to make ourselves the best we can be, only to be cast aside in lieu of or in favor of these other people who shouldn't be in these positions, until we start getting those roles, because we're going to fight for the discipline properly, we're going to represent the discipline properly, we're going to communicate with other people in the organization properly, and still we start getting these roles, we're going to be in a bad position. We're going to be in a compromised position. Oh, that is the top 10 sinister UX traits revisited. We hope these will resonate with you. Again, look at the list, the old list, listen to what we talked about. People will come up with different top 10 lists. And when it comes to organizational variation, some things will appear to be more critical than the ones that I just presented here. But that one, number one, that's the big one, folks. That one has to change across the entire discipline, or we're going to continue to suffer accordingly. So that is all the time we have for today, folks. Until next time, this is Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX, wishing everyone all the best. And as always, happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.